Cooper, who is director de recherche at the CNRS and Institut Jean Nicot, working at the interface of the social and the cognitive sciences. He wrote the paper with his PhD student, Hugo Mercier.
And Hugo is here and will help me answer the question. Normally we do a joint act, but since these are a relatively short presentation, I'll do it by myself. So this is indeed the last paper. It's also a bit of an outlier in terms of the themes. Nevertheless, we're trying to answer one of the questions which was raised in the invitation. What are the nature, causes, and mechanism of the emergent phenomenon by which a group can be more likely to solve its problem, obtain a more accurate information, or make more accurate prediction than any of its members on its own, including any expert in the group? So we're not focalizing on the very interesting, more technical problem that many of the papers have addressed, and I've learned a lot from listening to them, but a more general sociological problem. Before doing that, let's remember a bit that collective wisdom is beautiful when you get it, but you get the good, the bad, and the ugly. So the good, for instance, is this orchestra, not just because being an orchestra is a brilliant form of collective performance, but that's an orchestra which was founded by Edward Said and Daniel Barenboim together, and which joins Palestinian and Israeli musicians, so it's a nice form of collective wisdom. The bad, no comments. And the ugly, and this is the last lynching in the north in Indiana, 1930, 5,000 people took these two men out of a jail where they'd been put because they were accused of having killed someone and raped a woman, and they killed them in this manner. We approach the issue of collective wisdom, Hugo and I, as cognitive scientists, cognitive psychologists. And the important point for us is that different individual psychological dispositions are involved in different collective performances. So it's not that you just have the human mind doing its job on the basis of a kind of single mechanism in every case. And this has important consequences, namely that a deep understanding of collective performance is not compatible with shallow psychology. And let me repeat it, because, of course, that should be provocative to several of you, to social scientists in general. A deep understanding of collective performance is not compatible with shallow psychology. I mean, the social sciences have largely made the bet, which can be defended, it's not absurd, that indeed you can make do with shallow psychology, and we don't believe that this is so. Why? Because there is a basic disunity in human thought processes. Of course, the common view is that human thinking is a unified process, and this common view itself is based on our conscious access to our thoughts. So we know our thoughts, we seem to have a kind of unified picture of them, or we think we do. And also we have the ability, a relative ability, to integrate our conscious thought in a discursive form. So you get our thinking somehow displayed in this integrated manner. But if you look at empirical research in cognition, psychology, first, our conscious access to our thought has little to do with our conscious access to our thought processes. That is very poor. Our understanding of, it could be argued it's nil. We have no access to the processes themselves. Thought processes, with growing evidence and consensus, always, these things are always controversial, they are carried out by a variety of autonomous inference mechanisms. So there is not one mechanism, intelligence, thinking, or whatever, but many mechanisms which act and which are not that well coordinated, what is more. So inference in general, which is what it's all about here, inferences are processes that, given some input information, derive conclusion in a cognitively sound way. So it's a wide category, and it's inference is an essential ingredient of any cognitive system. It's an ingredient of perception. What you perceive is the light, say visually, is the light reflected by one side of an object, and what you perceive is the whole three-dimensional object, for instance. And so inference is found not just in humans, but in all cognitively endowed organisms, other animals in particular. Now, there's been a study of inference in psychology has gone in different directions, but now there's a growing, if not consensus, at least converging efforts suggesting that there are at least two categories of inference. And this goes under the name of dual process theories. So the idea is there are two distinct systems, or sets of systems, actually, underlying human inference. System one, as often called, is automatic, unconscious, parallel and fast inference, and we would argue that these are underlied by a great variety of different specialized inferential mechanisms or modules. And system two inference is controlled, conscious, serial, and slow. And when we think of reasoning, or we talk in an ordinary sense of reasoning, of course, what we have in mind is system two processes. And we have our own take on this distinction. We think there's something right in this distinction, and we work it out in a way which is not standard, but is in the general spirit of the dual process series. So let's first give an example of the kind of rapid automatic inferences which occur all the time and of which much of cognitive life is made. So now you're participants in an experiment. Please look at the screen, and you will have exactly 1 second to decide which of the two, there'll be two pictures there, which of these two politicians is more competent. Okay, you've made up your mind? I'm sure you have. Who thinks this guy on the right is the most competent? You could raise your hand if somebody thinks. Oh, thank you. One. Who thinks the guy on the left is more competent? Well, splendid. Now, these were two candidates to the U.S. Senate in the 2004 election in Wisconsin. The one on the left is Russ Feingold, who got elected with 55% of the votes. But the thing is, you knew him before. People get a decision in 1 second. In fact, you can bring it down to a tenth of a second and still get a decision. You know, is competence something that you can see in 1 second from a face? Well, apparently we think we do form such judgments. And the interesting thing is that if you look at the races, which are predicted just on the basis of this 1 second judgment of competence. And again, further, these are experiments by Todorov and others published in Science in 2005. More recent experiments involve a tenth of a second and are also predictive in the same manner. So the Senate races, out of 95 races, 71% are correctly predicted by this 1 second judgment of competence. And House of Representatives with 600 races, 66.8%. So that's kind of striking. But so the point is, we draw these inferences. They are kind of compelling. I mean, again, if you look again at Tutfeld, yeah, I was right. The fact is, if you're given not 1 second, but 5 minutes time to judge, you'd make the same judgment. Judgment doesn't change. I mean, the first impression is very robust. So these intuitive inferences, which are the base of the judgment we make all the time, we want to contrast them with reflective inferences. So most of our inferences, again, are intuitive inferences. We come to believe a conclusion, for instance, that the guy on the left is more competent without attention to or aware of the reason. I mean, it would be really hard put to say what it is about these two faces that makes one look more competent than the other. However, some of our intuitions are about reasons. So we have intuition about everything, about faces, about taste, about food, about reasons, about morality. So there is no domain of cognition about which we have we are unable to pass these intuitive judgments. So some of intuitions are precisely about reasons, that we come to believe in this intuitive manner that if you accept a set of premises, say P1, P2, Pn, that's a good reason to accept some conclusion C. And that's intuitive. So you, in the sense that you wouldn't be able to justify why there is this, these are reasons for that. But then they give you a reason, an explicit, a conscious reason to accept C. So if we then infer C from P1, P2, Pn, this is a reflective inference. We have attended to and are aware of the reasons for believing C. So let me give you a first kind of intuitive example. So you walk out of your house of the contrast. You see fast-moving dark clouds. You feel a strong chilly when you spontaneously come to expect that it might rain. A non-human animal might have exactly the same kind of inference. That's the case of intuitive inference. As opposed to you look at the barometer and at the thermometer, you see that both pressure and temperature have suddenly dropped, and you tell yourself, this means that it might rain. That's reflective inference. You're looking at the reason for a certain conclusion. But the fact that these are reasons is, you might be able to justify, but come a point where it's got to be grounded in intuition. Let me give you a more concrete example. The point we want to make is reflective inference is reasoning proper, and we will look at reasoning proper and its contribution to collective wisdom, which is what the conference is about. So here's an example of an appeal to... let me start again. Okay.
From Illinois was running for president. His opponents ridiculed him. as inexperienced and woefully unprepared. His only government experience had been service in the Illinois State Legislature, plus 2 years as an obscure member of Congress. He had never held an executive or management position of any kind. Yet this man was elected president twice. And they said he was unprepared.
Okay, the interesting thing here, of course, it also appeals to lots of intuitions, nice faces, and so on and so on, and also for the very comprehension of the argument, because the argument is largely, come on, please, move to the next. I'm for Obama, but not to the point of wanting to stop my lecture just to. No, please not. Okay.
It hijacks your computer.
It's okay. Okay. So what you get there, in fact, is you do a piece of reasoning, but you're provided, it's an antithematic argument, because you're provided just with a small element. You're told that they said that he, actually Lincoln itself, as you have to infer, was unprepared, and so further back argument. For a long time you think they're talking about Obama, and what the argument is, and they implied that therefore he wouldn't be a good president. All that's in blue is not said. Lincoln was a great president, therefore the argument against Lincoln was not good. They said that Obama is unprepared, and they implied that therefore he would not be a good president. By parity of reasoning, the argument is not good against Obama. The whole thing takes 30 seconds, but you understand, you reconstruct the full meaning, and you go through the argument, and you understand that this is a reason not to accept the argument. I mean, you understand, you're given reasons for a conclusion, and the conclusion itself is about an argument which you have understood. So it's rather elaborate reasoning that goes on in this fast manner, 30 seconds as opposed to one. In fact, as opposed, you might bring it down to 10 seconds, but then you can bring the judgment of competence to a tenth of a second, so it's 100 times longer, still pretty fast. So why the issue is, why do humans have reasoning at all? Why do we have the ability to attend to reasons in order to come to some conclusion when we, in fact, we are pretty good at drawing intuitive inference? As you said, the guy is more competent. I'll trust you on that. So the evolutionary argument is parallel to a famous argument, a classical argument regarding cooperation. The argument regarding cooperation goes like this. Cooperation is advantageous to honest cooperators, but even more so to cheaters, defectors, free riders. Hence, for cooperation to evolve, cheating must be prevented. And in the case of human cooperation, where cooperation takes place in lots of different domains, the prevention is largely done by cognitive means. Now, in a parallel manner, you look at communication, which is in a certain sense a form of cooperation. Communication is advantageous to honest communicators, but even more so to those, to dishonest ones, those who will not hesitate to mislead you and deceive you and so on when it's in their interest. Hence, for communication to evolve, communicated information must be adequately filtered. And in the human case, it is filtered in particular, I will argue, by means of reasoning. In fact, if you think about both the advantages of communication are so great and the vulnerability created by communication is so great that you expect the evolutionary pressure for mechanisms that help filtering information to have been particularly important. So there are varieties of ways that communicated information can be filtered, and again, the assumption is that all of them have evolved. Further, issues of trust, and you develop a capacity to trust people who are benevolent and competent, that is good source of information. In fact, this ability develops in very young children. To trust or mistrust them in an appropriate manner. You may watch for behavioral signs of honesty and dishonesty. They're not very good, but still better watch for them than not at all. And what is of interest here, you can check communicated information for consistency. That's one of the best tests of reliable information. First, of course, if it's internally inconsistent, then it's not reliable. And liars have a problem that they may come up with an initial statement which is consistent, but if they have to go on with the lie, inconsistencies are likely to crop up because they want to maintain external consistency, that is consistency with what is already known, and that's not easy to achieve. So now if you're talking to an audience like you are now, who is cautious, you're not willing to accept what I'm saying on trust. In fact, you'll accept what I'm saying, if you do at all, only because I will have properly argued for it. So what I've got to do is, rather than asserting directly what you won't accept just by saying, oh, Dan said it, so it must be true, I must help you infer it. I may give evidence and arguments for the conclusion. I may help you, you derive intended conclusion, as was the case in the little ad for Obama. I may highlight logical and evidential relations between premises that the audience is willing to accept and the intended message. So argumentation, that is developing reasons, highlighting reasons, is, we claim, the main function, the evolved function of reasoning. So arguing consists in displaying the consistency relationship between premises the audience is willing to accept and conclusion which they won't accept on trust, basically. And arguing is a relatively costly, hard-to-fake, honest display strategy. I won't comment on that. For those who are familiar with evolutionary theory, they'll see what I'm alluding to. So, as we pointed out, reasoning on the one hand is something that is reflective. You're aware of the reason. You have to accept a conclusion. But the relationship between the reasons and the conclusion itself is intuitive. Reasoning involves intuitions about logical and evidential relationship among representations. And the resources for deriving these intuitions are activated in a dialogic context, in a context where you're trying to convince others or you're trying not to be too easily convinced, whether the dialogic context is actually intended or imagined as you get it in experimental situation. A parenthesis here, one of the reasons to put this issue in an evolutionary perspective is that understanding what the function of reasoning may be among humans will help you understand better some of the features of the structure of reasoning and the condition under which it works well. It's likely to be working well in the condition for which it particularly it directly evolved. So this leads to a number of predictions. On a classical view, if you think of reasoning, a Cartesian view, you think of reasoning as a general ability to enhance your cognition, it should apply across the board. And its successes and failures should be accounted for by the limited capacity of reasoning or the difficulty of a task, and not by extraneous factors. From the point of view of this kind of argumentative theory that we are proposing, reasoning should be triggered more easily in dialogic and argumentative contexts. So the issue is, when is reasoning efficient? Well, a very well-known fact in all the psychology of reasoning is when you present people with a deductive reasoning problem, for instance, in a non-contextualized manner, they're pretty bad, they're really very bad. So it must be said, to quote Evans, who is one of the best specialists, that logical performance in abstract reasoning tasks is generally quite poor. The most famous task in psychology of reasoning is the weighs and selection task, which has a simple deductive solution, but where typically about 10% of the participants manage to find it. When the task is of an abstract form. So how do we explain this poor performance? Classical view, again, cognitive limitation. The reasoning abilities are poor, even unless they are being they have been taught to be better, working memory may be limited, and so on. The view we would argue for is that the conditions for the full activation of the reasoning modules are not met in your abstract experimental situation. If you look at reasoning in situation of argumentation as opposed to reasoning in decontextualized situation, you suddenly you realize that people who seem to be very bad, if you just look at the psychology of reasoning, fare much better when they're presented with argumentation problems. So very briefly, it's been shown that here you have a reference that people are good at making the difference between explanation and evidence, at building counter-arguments, at understanding the macrostructure of arguments, and understanding burden of proof arguments, at recognizing circular reasoning, at using hypothetical thinking in argumentation, at recognizing fallacies, and so on and so on. So a lot of problems which are fairly complex in terms of the logical properties, when they are presented in an argumentative context, people suddenly seem to fare well, the same people who do very badly in standard reasoning tasks. Group reasoning, and that's where we come to something like collective performance, if not exactly collective wisdom. What the argumentative theory predicts is that people should be better at recognizing good arguments and justification than at constructing them. Is the function of argumentation is from the point of view of a communicator to convince others, and from the point of view of a recipient to filter properly the information, basically, if there is an imbalance, an asymmetry, it should be in favor of filtering. There is no point of being able to reason beyond what your audience can evaluate. On the other hand, there's good reason to try to be ahead in your evaluation of reasons ahead of a communicator. So pressure will go this way. So hence, group processes may improve performance. That is, people have been fairly good at being better at evaluating arguments than at producing them will be able to recognize good arguments if they produce among them and accept them, and therefore the group should do better than the average of its members. In fact, if people come with bad arguments, the evaluation capacities should make all realize that the arguments are bad and give some incentive to try and produce a better argument, and then you get you should get a performance that's better than that of any of the members of the group. And indeed, that's what you get in a number of experiments. So if you look, so the general principle is that good argument wins. Good arguments win. I want to stop on that. I mean, truth wins. Good arguments win. This shows that people are good reasoners, not at the production, but at least at evolution. It's quite remarkable. I mean, if people can understand a good argument and see that it's correct, then they show a certain form of reasoning ability that is on the evaluation side as high as is complex the argument. And this is indeed what we find. It's the fact that good argument that wins, that truth wins, for instance, in mathematical and logical problems or in inductive problems, as shown by Laughlin and his collaborators, is in itself quite remarkable. I mean, we know it intuitively. I mean, we know it as a daily life matter. But if you think of it, what it means for human reasoning capacities is quite remarkable. And to the ways and selection task, which I mentioned before, which is the task most often used in the psychology of reasoning, as I said, typically has in individual resolution fairly poor performance. So these are experiments of Moshman and Guile. In individual resolution, you get, with their population, 18% of participants giving correct answer. Now, you put them in group, and then you get 80% good answers. And again, it's what happens is not only that you get cases where one of the participants had a good answer and the others recognize it, also they may all initially have had bad answers, but were able to evaluate each other's answers and therefore find the incentive to find a better one. Another typical phenomenon well known in the reasoning of literature is put in a new light if you approach reasoning in this argumentative perspective as we are suggesting. So this is the ubiquitous confirmation bias. What happens is that people prefer give a preferential treatment to the hypothesis that they start that they support to begin with, that goes in the direction of their own beliefs. They typically overweigh the examples that fit their beliefs. They find in the data, in the evidence only, what they're looking for. They find it very difficult to revise their own beliefs. And they have problems with generating counter-arguments against claims that they hold. So these are all results from individual experiments. You present people problems of that structure, and this is the difficulty that they typically exhibit. Now, how can you explain the existence of this confirmation bias? So the classical view is that, well, this confirmation bias in lots of cases provide you with useful heuristics. And in other cases, not. So the experiment typically tricks useful heuristics by creating context where they're not useful, where they lead to bad results. And such non-useful, so bad contexts are fairly frequent in real life. The view we suggest is different. Basically, the point of our ability to produce arguments and to evaluate arguments, to produce arguments, has to do with being able to win arguments, to convince others. And for that, look for the arguments which go. I mean, the thesis that you defend, the view you defend, is already there. How do you defend it best? It's a debating problem and not a problem of converging to the truth. Win a debate. And from this point of view, all these biases are indeed the right biases you should should have is the function of production of argument was indeed to convince others of a view that is already held. But when you move from the experiment with just individual of to a collective situation, whether in an experimental setting or in a natural setting, then what you're dealing with is a kind of division of cognitive labor. Cognitive labor in the sense that each group, people having different views, defending each their own views, but all being good evaluators of arguments, are likely indeed to converge towards a better epistemic state. So the division of argumentative labor is likely to succeed, not in every condition, but in particular if people interacting have competing viewpoints and a common interest in truth, as is typically the case in science. So it's not that every situation will be so favorable as that, but often enough, indeed, you get a judicial procedure are typically organized as adversarial procedures to permit the same kind of situation to obtain. And then this argumentative function of reasoning plays its role in a positive manner, helps to develop collective wisdom. On the other hand, if the people interacting have a common interest in defending a given single viewpoint, groupthink, as the expression has been used many times here, what you get is a runaway exaggeration of that viewpoint. That's what means you, as you get in political or religious fanaticism. Or to give just one experimental example from a work by Schade, Sunstein, and Kahneman. So you look at these are experiments done with mock juries, in cases where they found some defendant guilty and it's a problem of giving punitive award, you compare the individual punitive award the value that people are members of jury are individually willing to give, so that's statistical juries, you do the means of a group, and then you have them deliberate and see what they come up to. And typically, that's what you get on average in these 500 mock juries done using this experiment on 15 of cases. In the cases where the gap was the greatest, it was really, I don't remember by how much, but about 100 or something like that, very, very, very high differences. So you get a kind of runaway exaggeration resulting from the fact that they all agree that punishment should be given, and they reinforce each other's view as to how much it should be the case. So to come to conclusions, we argue that reasoning is a mental mechanism with a primary social function, producing reasons to convince others and evaluating reasons given by others so as not to be too easily convinced, to be convinced when it's appropriate to be so. This function, we claim, helps explain the success and failures of individual reasoning. So it throws light on the many results in the literature on individual reasoning that are already there. And it also helps explain how reasoning in groups can contribute to collective wisdom or, in some cases, to collective madness. Thank you.
The first claim appearing is to convince that massive modularity and dualistic view are compatible. So this point was less in your talk, but so you have a definition of massive modularity and of dualistic view, and you demonstrate that the two are compatible. The other point is about inferential processes that are, in your view, domain-specific as other cognitive processes. And for evolutionary reasons, you assert that there is an argumentation module specialized in argumentation relationship between conceptual representations. And as you have said, argumentation module is for a function of social communication. And your point is that the main function of reasoning is about the problem, how to deal with human reliance on communicated information. And you gave in your paper, as in your talk, some evidence from a lot of experimental studies. And they are quite striking and very interesting because they are less pessimistic than we think usually. Is that when we give tasks with a real answer, a correct answer, people, groups are better than for vague answer. And there are more bias when the task is to evaluate a belief or an hypothesis or a thesis than if a task is to resolve a problem. And you say also that in good condition, people are good at arguing in debate. So it's quite a view different than the view we heard, we can see usually. I think the main point out of a technical point in your discipline is that reasoning is best in cost-benefit term for communication situation. I have maybe four questions, maybe quite far from your concerns or questions, naive questions. As your thesis is around the massive modularity, one question I can have is there a limited number of modules? I guess that not, but I don't know. The other question around the theory of massive modularity, it is about the integration of modules. You know, there is an old analogy, and I'm quite sure you refuse this analogy, is that mind is like a little society. Maybe it's not a good analogy, but it gives some question. If the mind is a kind of committee of modules, is there a chairman? Maybe not. Maybe in this theory, chairman is not useful. But there is a mechanism, which is, in your paper, the competition for attention, which give priority at a moment facing a task to a module or a cognitive mechanism. Is there only this competition for attention as a way to integrate, if it is needed, all these modules? My third question is about the very interesting results of experimental studies you mentioned. In the literature on deliberation, authors have emphasized a lot about social psychological result about polarization. And my question was, in the studies with problem-solving tasks, where the group performances are the best, is there some phenomenon of polarization or not at all? So it's a question about the literature. And fourth point, it's maybe less serious. I would like to know how your conception of argumentation is very rational, as usually, and we can make the difference between arguing and persuading, using only rational points and using passions, emotions. But how could you complicate your way of understanding human activity to give a kind of representation of a trial? And in the trial, the discourses of the lawyers in the Ciceronian perspective, you know, at the end of a discourse, there is the peroraison. I don't know the English word. And for Cicero, we have to mix docere and movere, demonstration, argumentation, and appeal to the patience. So I think it's possible to mix for you the different kind of activity, but I would like to know how you do.
So we'll share the answers with Hugo. Ça c'est pour toi, parce que moi je suis branché. Regarding the last point, I think the little ad for Obama was a good example of mixing arguments and passion. It clearly played on both, and it's a very interesting study. I don't have any particular contribution to make here. I mean, it's, I'm interested in the relationship between the psychological and the social. And of course, if you look at the complex interaction like those involving Cicero and so on, typically the variety of means of persuasion are used together. So argumentation is only one of them. But just to underline that you're right to underscore this important aspect. Regarding modularity, I didn't develop it in this whole presentation for a reason of time. Yes, indeed. I mean, the notion, and I argued here just for a weaker notion, namely that there's some disunity or complexity to human reasoning abilities. The strong version of that, which I do defend, is that it involves a great variety of specialized modules. How many? It's a fixed number. It's 1,272 or whatever. What I'm basically, I think there are a great many innate modules, many of which are learning modules, for which you acquire specialized expertise, some of which are very locally specialized, some are greater, so there is no fixed number, but it's clearly finite, and I think it's a high number. So I defend not only massive modularity, but also teaming, modularité grouillante. The view I would defend, and it's not the place to do so, is that there is no central command mechanism, and that you get a kind of invisible hand effect through a competition of all the modules for resources, for energetic resources, which if the system is both phylogenetically and ontogenetically well, has evolved properly and developed properly, will indeed have beneficial epistemic effect. Again, another topic. Thank you for asking the question, but I can't do more than allude to ways to answer it at present. Hugo will answer regarding the experimental evidence.
So you asked the question about polarization and what it does in that kind of intellective task we were talking about. So first of all, the general point about polarization. So it seems to me that the case for polarization may be slightly overblown, because when you read Sunstein, he speaks of a law of group polarization. And actually, when you look back to the literature in social psychology in the 60s and 70s, the common wisdom was that actually groups would tend to converge to the mean of the individuals. So it was very striking at the time to have some experiments starting to show some phenomena of polarization. So at best, it's not a law. I mean, something that can happen for sure in some contexts, but it's far from being a strong regularity. And as for how that would apply to the intellective task we're talking about, well, it's not easy, because since they are intellective, usually you tend to have a right answer, and it's sort of hard to be, you know, more right than the right answer. And the closest thing you'd get would be the assembly bonus effect. So in which case, so the classical case is the best twin thing. And so you've got one individual who has the right answer and who's going to manage to convince the others. And you can have a sort of polarization, in which case you have different people pulling their answers together and getting to an answer that is actually better than that of the best individual. So it's not the same thing as polarization, first of all, because it's a good thing. And second of all, because, I don't know, it doesn't really fit the pattern of polarization. It's just that the answer of the group is indeed different from that of the individuals, but in that case, it's better.
No, no, we finished. We've given our son de Westminster de ce côté si bien.
I think I can see how the asymmetry in cognitive skills of speakers and listeners could produce collective wisdom. I think I can see it, but I would like to hear more about the evidence for the asymmetry. Let me just mention a couple of things. I seem to remember that Ekman claims that we are both bad at faking emotional expressions and bad at detecting fakers. I don't think he claims that there is an asymmetry. And from first principles, you would think that by virtue of the evolutionary arms race, if one side at some point had an advantage, then you know the other side, the listener or the speaker, the faker or the detector, you know, there would be a selection for improved skills. So I just wonder, what's the evidence for the asymmetry?
Well, as far as the evolutionary argument is concerned, you might have to figure in the cost and benefits. So if the costs of being cheated or you know being lied to are very high, then you mean the receiver has more incentive to be a good to have good filtering mechanisms.
So this would essentially depend on the structure in the payoff structure in the prisoner's dilemma, whether it's better to be a free rider or worse to be a sucker or things like that. You know,
yeah.
So we'd have to and you would have to reconstruct the reward structure in the early hominid context.
Good luck.
Regarding the Ekman experiments, they are really striking results, which we all have in mind. So nevertheless, I would not overblow them. People are not very good at detecting liars and so on. That doesn't mean that they are. That I don't think the data shows that we're not good at all, and that the sense we have about honesty of other people on the basis of behavioral aspect is totally unjustified. And it would be a complex argument why this should be so from an evolutionary point of view. That is, in a nutshell, when people present themselves as honest, with a nice, honest face, it's a kind of strategy which can backfire if I don't deliver the goods. So it's a kind of display of honesty that in ongoing interactions, at least, not in one kind of interaction, is not worth doing unless you're indeed willing to provide honest information. Of course, in a society of anonymity, you get the perfect swindler who really looks the most honest person and swindle one person after the other. But that's a different case.
Yes, you made this argument that we've heard a few other times earlier, which is that crowds are not good at creating arguments but are good at evaluating arguments. This may be true for the ways in selection task, but going back to my own area of economics, there's some counterexamples that really stand out. There's a number of areas where the only arguments that economists can give are wrong. The only arguments that are effective are wrong, and we know they're wrong. And on the other hand, the arguments that we think are actually right are just not actually effective in persuading a general audience. So in the case of free trade, the argument that economists think is most solid is comparative advantage, but that's almost impossible to sell to a general audience. When economists go before a general audience, what do they say? One is they try to claim that it will create jobs, which they know is not really, first of all, probably not true in the long run, and second of all, not a very good argument anyway. Another thing that you can say, and actually if you go to the president's website for the argument in favor of adopting CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, he makes the argument that the U.S. will win in all markets, and therefore Americans should favor it. Hopefully no one from Central America will look at the website and realize that this is all part of an American plot to take over their entire economies and disemploy everyone in the country. And then finally, one other argument that actually is effective is saying that if America doesn't sign this agreement, Japan will. And Japan will then go and push us aside. And these are the arguments that actually work. Or just to take one other example, when economists want to argue in favor of immigration, the only argument that's effective is saying immigrants take jobs Americans won't take. Now, we know this is wrong because it's take at what wage. If we were to boot out all immigrants, wages would rise and eventually some Americans would take these jobs. We know this is correct. We know the right argument is to talk about comparative advantage again, but that is not actually effective. So this seems to be a case where the arguments that actually are, at least many economists would say, demonstrably valid, are almost useless as an appeal to the public. And the only way to actually get any leverage is to say things that were really wrong.
Well, obviously there are going to be exceptions, but the general pattern that is observed in social psychology is that if the people are indeed motivated, I mean, interested in the topic, which they might not be in that case, when and I mean, for wrong reasons, maybe they're not interested for wrong reasons, but it happens that maybe they're not really interested in, you know, the theory about, you know, free trade.
And so I mean, when there's interest in getting the right answer and there's interest in the topic, I think the problem is we have a surplus of interest in the topic, but with very little
from
interest
people,
in getting the
right
answer. Are
you really sure that people are...
There may not be an interest in the actual claims of the theory. Mm-hmm. So we have a strong interest in the consequences. Yeah. That doesn't necessarily translate...
Yeah. So people are passionate about the question, but they're not really interested in getting the right answer.
Yeah, but, and so then again, when they are, they seem to be sort of good at you know, making up good from bad arguments, so...
Yeah, but how often in politics are the questions really that cold that people will just look at them and say, I just want the facts, that's it?
Indeed.
Yeah, I have a question about the claim that you made. It bears on something that came up yesterday, which was that the internal consistency of a source of information is, I think the way you put it, is the best or a very good indicator of reliability. So I have a question about this, and I'm afraid the answer might just be obvious, so I'll just plead jet lag at the beginning and just help me out with this. But so if you have a set of information or a source, and you know it's internally inconsistent, and you know about another source that it's internally consistent, one thing you know for sure is that the first one can't be completely right, mm-hmm. and you know the second one could be completely right. Mm-hmm. That's no evidence at all yet about what fraction of their answers will be correct. Is that that's right? So analytically, we still don't know which one's more reliable. Mm-hmm. So now, is there an analytic proof that somehow the reliable one is more likely to be right? I mean, the consistent one? Or is it an empirical correlation with what kind of... I just don't know.
Just have to think of the paradox of a preface. I mean, when you write in the preface that you're sure you've made some mistake, nevertheless, you assert every one of the statements you write in your book. So it's got to do with the amount of information you're providing, its diversity, its complexity. So there may be inconsistencies in an overall very good source of information. Also, you have to factor in not just the epistemic quality of a source of information, but its relevance. And that's, in fact, more important. So, it's the issue of checking for consistency is, as we describe, the process we're describing is an ongoing process in terms of when online processing of discourse, like you had 30 seconds for the Obama ad, and that's what we're talking about. We're not talking about moving back and looking for, which what might be worth doing, but looking for an algorithm which would allow you to infer from degree of consistency to value of a source.
Right, but I still don't see why it would be any evidence. I mean, so...
It's an evidence...
Let's make sure we mean the same thing by reliability. I mean, in epistemology, sometimes it just means the frequency of correctness over the whole set of answers. Is that what we mean here?
Okay.
So you get two sources, one's inconsistent, one's consistent. It's just no information about what the fraction of correct answers will be.
No, but I know, of course, but I know that one of them...
All you know is that one of them can't be completely right, exactly. But that's not the question.
Of course, but we're not talking about a situation where I have to choose between two sources, a consistent and inconsistent one. We're talking about a situation where somebody is presenting you with a certain argument and you see that the argument is inconsistent. Do you accept the conclusion on the basis of this argument? That's the situation.
If it's just the point that it's an invalid argument, then no, you wouldn't accept it on the basis of logic. But you wouldn't deny it on the grounds, as far as I can tell, that this looks like it must be an unreliable source. We have no evidence that it's an unreliable
source. The inference was
not
about the quality of the source. The inference we're talking about is about the acceptability, the reason, the quality of a conclusion, the reason you have to accept the conclusion. Inferring about sources is another. I mean, I mentioned that you pass judgment on competence and benevolence of sources, and that's a complex kind of thing. Yeah. And you're certainly not going to exclude sources because they're sometimes inconsistent. That's not a reason to say, oh, that source is unreliable or is less reliable than a source that's always consistent. It's easy to be always consistent. Two is bigger than one, three is bigger than one, four is bigger than one. I can go on indefinitely producing new statements and I will be consistent. Mm-hmm. Okay. But I won't be a very good source of information for relevance reasons in this case.
I want to push you sort of in a different direction, and that is that when you talked about the confirmation bias with information, mm-hmm. right, which reminds me of sort of the old Festinger literature, right, on sort of avoiding cognitive dissonance. Mm-hmm. To what extent does brain research suggest that there is sort of consistency across the ways we think? And let me think of this the following way. So there's all this information out there in the world, And let's suppose that, you know, coming out of the birth canal, that Adrian just has more capacity than I have, right, to acquire these sets of skills. But if the sort of story you're telling, it rings true, the sets of things he's going to acquire are going to have some degree of consistency to them, because some arguments are going to be, he's going to, you know, not learn arguments or not learn information that doesn't support what he thinks. He's also going to even acquire sort of heuristics and ways of thinking that are sort of complements to what he already knows. Well, that would suggest that people have sort of, in some sense, vectors of skills and understandings, which would mean that even an incredibly bright person would still be very narrow in a particular way, right? Which would give sort of a brain theory view for why, you know, for why collective wisdom could in some ways really trump individual wisdom, right? It would also in some sense support some of, what Brian's saying about how, economists all know this, right? And nobody else sort of agrees with it, right? And it would be because the economists have acquired a particular vector of skills to which them they seem like just obvious things that anybody should understand. But for other people's vectors of skills and understanding it, it's not such an obvious thing. But it seems like if you can make a brain, you know, I agree with you about the shallowness argument, but it's one of the things that I worry about in doing research in this area. I mean, to what extent do I have to understand, is it true that individuals really do have this sort of narrowness because of this cognitive dissonance issue?
Well, I wouldn't be able to tell much about the brain, and I'm not sure that there really is a lot of brain research going on that would really allow to answer that question. As far as the biases are concerned, you might want to be careful about distinguishing different levels of coherence. And on some very unconscious level, on some very basic level, your behavior has to be sort of coherent at some point. And that is probably quite different from what Festinger and most other social psychologists had in mind, in which you had something dissonant in your conscious thought, and like you could, you know, do something that would be different from what something you said earlier. And actually, it's a very social process. So the main problem would be that other people would be able to spot that incoherence, and they would think of you as a fool or someone who, you know, does things wrongly. And so the two things are a bit different. And as for the biases, well, I'm not totally sure it's linked to this coherence, I mean, to the dissonance literature, but it might be. And generally, the literature on the biases is quite clear that these things are extremely prevalent and strong, and it's basically impossible to get rid of them. And so, yeah, I mean, that's one of the things that make us say that these biases, these confirmation and disconfirmation biases, are features of reasoning. I mean, they are there for a reason. They are not just flows, not, you know, some random mistake around. I mean, it's something that is really, that's what it's designed to do, to be biased.
I want just to remind us of what Christian yesterday proposed, degrees of coherence. And so we don't hold, most of us, I hope, proposition of form P, not P. We may hold P somewhere and not P elsewhere. Maybe we don't. But then more, when it involves higher level, we all have lots of inconsistencies in our heads. And it's no big obstacle to living a decent life.
Dan, I have just a clarification question about the two pictures you showed us. You asked who is more competent. And then it turned out that the more competent for us was also elected. Yes. Now, what do you think? I mean, that there is a connection between competence and being elected?
That's what is claimed in these studies of Todorov. I mean, they looked at fast judgment on people's face. So competence is only one form of trustworthiness. You get a very fast, very consistent, and a tenth of a second judgment is the same that you, when you get, if you get 10 minutes to look at the face. But it's a much weaker predictor of electoral success in those races they looked at than is the judgment of competence. So
did they sometimes ask, who do you think will be elected?
I don't think they did in the experience. I know they took basically election, either who had taken place or before the election took place, did the study and then got published it after they had the results were in. And clearly the best predictor among all these psychological traits and the controls are done very well, was this very intuitive judgment of competence. Whatever it's called.
I'm too tired to explain why I think this, what you're talking about, is pretty insane. I mean, it's a mystery. I mean, there's no explanation. It's a complete faux raccord. There's no connection between the judgment of competence and the results. I mean, there must be something there because there's a regularity, but I really am completely not satisfied by the explanation. But I wanted actually to throw the ball back to Brian's question, and I was a little disappointed, so please, I'm offering you a second chance. You see, Brian, when you say that these things are bad arguments, I am a colleague of yours. I have no idea. I'm just as bad as the people who are unable to detect the right argument, what you call the right argument, and detect what you call the wrong arguments. And why? Because I'm very ignorant about economics. And the things that are Hugo and Dan are referring to are much more elementary, basic arguments. So, and this is not just to say that there's a mistake somewhere. It's an interesting issue, which is that in order for us to evaluate political and economic arguments, which are of the utmost importance and on which it's very important that the common citizen, me included, has a considered and a good judgment, is that there is, on the one hand, a certain evaluation module of arguments that Dan and Hugo are talking about, and it's good that the news there is more positive than used to be thought some decades ago. But the second thing is that there's a matter of trust. I mean, there's no way that I'm going to make a considered opinion on economic issues of the sort if I can't somehow combine my fallacy-detecting module, my validating module on the elementary level, with a sort of trust setup or module or whatnot that allows me to detect in you, Brian, a trustworthy and clear specialist of economics, and detect that the other guy is incompetent or untrustworthy or something like that.